Ghoulish greetings, everyone. Those tunes are courtesy of my good friend, Bobby Mackey. And I, of course, am your host, Tessa Morrow. Now today it's a different place, all the same with a new face, with strange mysteries hanging in the air. People in their sane minds swear they see you today. Are you looking for the love they took away? Everyone knows that you couldn't bear the pain. You took your life in the pouring rain. Thanks for stopping by and making Paranormal Prowlers Podcast part of your morning, day, night, graveyard shift. Whenever you listen and wherever you are listening from on top of a mountain to the middle of the biggest city, from desert to island, and everything in between, it's greatly appreciated. This week's special city shoutouts go to Commerce, Georgia, Mol, Belgium, Cobleskill, New York, Monroe, Pennsylvania, Saint-Avold, France, and Frankfurt, Germany. So I have to say that several of the countries that I just mentioned, my grandfather was stationed at or went through during his time in the war. And I find that very appropriate as this is, yes, a grandpa episode. Belgium, France, Germany. And yes, he did go to New York as well when he was stationed in New Jersey. So pretty cool stuff. Pretty appropriate, if I do say so myself. Welcome to part 6 of my grandfather's adventure during the Second World War, where we left off with the Italian campaign. Well, we rewind back a little, and after spending time at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, God bless my grandpa, he hated that area, and spending time in AP Hill in Virginia, him and the boys are now going to take a little cruise to foreign land. And before I dive into this journal entry, I'd like to say that for the past month, I have been busy writing a book about my grandfather. He's the original author, of course. I'm using his writing. When he was at war, in a letter he wrote home saying, quote, "When I get home, I'm going to write a book about this." Well, I'm honored to say that 80 years after he came home from the war, his eldest granddaughter is doing exactly that for him. It's been a great project, which involves me digging deep into my family's phenomenal history. And let's just say that I'm 220 pages in this book, and I feel like I'm just getting started. All right, let's dive right in. Everybody seemed pretty serious that morning. There wasn't a great deal said, and it was awful quiet around there. Soon we had our rolls all packed and strapped on our backs, our belts loaded with ammunition, our rifles swung over our shoulders, and we loaded on a train which slowly pulled out and headed for Staten Island, New York. As we rolled along toward our destination, we noticed many, many people who seemed to know that all of us on that train we're spending our very last hours for a long time in the dear old United States, and they gave us a cheery wave and a smile of good luck. We got to Staten Island about 2 o'clock, and after waiting around about 2 hours, we went to the docks and into a huge building which had a sign reading Port of Embarkation over its portals. We hung around there for several hours. Then finally, we lined up single file and walked through a small gate as they checked and counted us, which reminded me of a bunch of sheep being checked and counted as they go from the corral to the boxcar, and went into a side door of a big gray ship, which was to be our home for the next 19 days. We were taken down to the hold of the ship, which was below water level and comparable to the basement of a house. The ship was much too small for the number of men they piled on it. If I remember correctly, there were 2,400 men on it, and it was originally built to accommodate about 1,000. The ship, the St. Elena, was an old Italian liner, and in its day it must have been pretty classy. Now, though, it was quite a mess. If you ever want to wreck anything, just let a bunch of soldiers get around it. Our living quarters were simply terrible. Down in the hold, there was four large rooms, and right underneath them was four more rooms the same size. They had portable bunks, three high over, almost every available inch of space. In the room that I was in, there were at least 175 men packed like sardines. Sometimes the ventilation facilities would work, other times they wouldn't. Most of the time, they wouldn't. We all felt pretty discouraged when we got on that day, but I was so completely worn out after all the hustle and bustle of loading and after the previous sleepless night that I grabbed the first bunk I got to, and in a few seconds, I was dead to the world. I awoke the next morning at 3 a.m., November 1st, with the strangest feeling I ever experienced. The boat was rocking and swaying, and I knew that we were on our way. So many different thoughts passed through my mind. Where are we going? Will there be any subs? Will there be any sea battles? When will I see my dear parents and family again? Will I get seasick? I went back to sleep with a clouded mind. I awoke later in the morning, and my first thought was to get up on deck and look around. And as I opened the door, I stood speechless and saw a tremendously awe-inspiring sight. We were moving through the waters at a fast rate of speed, already out of sight of land, and we were part of a huge convoy. Every direction you looked, there were ships, troop transports, freighters, destroyers, subchasers, cruisers, and battleships, and a large aircraft carrier. Up above us, I counted eight dirigibles who were there to escort us part of the way. They were very effective in sighting subs. It was really a thrill seeing all that stuff there, and I thought to myself, look out, Hitler. That morning, we got our first taste of chow that I honestly don't think was fit for a good dog. We were marched single file up to the mess hall, which was once a magnificent ballroom. It was four flights up from the hold where we stayed. There were so many men on that ship that they served in shifts all day long. One day you may get breakfast at 6 a.m. and lunch at 11 a.m. The next day breakfast was at 10:30 a.m. and lunch was at 2 p.m. And that's the way it was. Every day was a different hour. The food was almost unbearable. It was dirty and some of it stank. The bread was dry and hard and had no taste whatsoever. There was no butter. Rumor was that most of the food was bought in Africa, and some of it was as much as 5 years old. There was something to that rumor, too, because several months after we had landed, we heard that someone, God bless him, had heard of the sorry conditions on the boat, reported them, and when the boat got back to New York, an investigation was held, and all the food on board, except that of the officers and ship's crew, was ordered thrown in the ocean. Up in what was once a cocktail lounge, they sold candy, cigarettes, pop, etc. And every day there was a line halfway around the ship trying to get in there. The reason there was such a rush there is because the guys, they would buy candy by the boxes, and instead of going to chow, they would eat candy. But a guy just can't stand eating nothing but candy. I got so that I couldn't stand the sight of a candy bar. After a few days, the ship's crew would need men to help on certain details around the boat, so they were given privates to help them. The ship's crew and sailors really had good chow, steak and French fries every day, pies and cakes, ham and fresh eggs for breakfast. The privates that helped on the details got to eat all day with the ship's crew. When word of that got around, there was a riot caused by the guys volunteering for something to do. And eventually, it ended up that all the high-ranking non-coms were doing the details such as KP, scrubbing the floors and walls, etc. Things that they would never think of doing any other time. But to work meant to eat. The last week we were on the ship, I got rather a soft job, spending about 7 hours a day guarding a door down to the crew's mess. Boy, did I eat those last few days. I also got in pretty good with the chief steward, and he let me take baths in his private bathroom using fresh water. Down in the hold, there was two large bathrooms with about 20 washbowls and 5 showers apiece. The wash water was salt water. And if you have ever tried to wash or bathe or shave in salt water, you'll understand how futile it is. You just can't work up a lather. You can imagine how packed the two lavatories were with so many hundred guys using them. And the scarcity of baths really made it rough down in the holds, well, with the poor ventilation. After about the first 10 days, there was a terrible stench, and the guys got so they would stay out on the decks half or all of the night. Thus were the living conditions on the boat. We were taught different bell signals such as alert, fire, abandon ship, and so on. And we were told that anytime the bells rang, it would either be practice or the real thing, but we were never told what it was to be. The alert was rang almost every day. That meant that everyone, no matter where they were or what they were doing, had to, in a fast and orderly way, get out on the decks. One strict rule that definitely had to be followed was that every person had to have his Mae West life jacket on at all times. And after a few days, we were told that we never knew when we might have to abandon ship, so we were advised not to take our clothes off when we went to bed. One thing that I really appreciated was a photograph recording device, which was amplified just about all over the boat, and they had a swell bunch of records which were played almost constantly. The worst attack of homesickness that I got on the voyage was one night when I was standing guard on the closed-in and completely dark deck. The waters were unusually rough. There was no one around me at all, and I was naturally thinking of my home. When someone played a recording of My Rosary by Bing Crosby, which was really beautiful, I've always liked that selection for some reason or other, and every time I hear it, it makes me think of Mom. That night, it really forced a lump in my throat, and I'm kind of glad that it was pitch dark and that there was no one else around. The days went by, and they really seemed like long days, as did the nights. The time that I most enjoyed was just that sunset, and I always tried to be on deck as the sun was setting. I think one could see pictures then that no artist could ever put on a canvas. The first Saturday, we were told that church services would be held Sunday and that we could have our confessions heard that night. The waves were really knocking the ship about, and before I go on, I want to say that the greater part of the voyage was spent on very, very rough waters. So I stumbled a half a dozen times as I went up to the room of the chaplain's that night. I hadn't seen him before, and after I knocked at his door, I was somewhat surprised when a very young and good-looking man opened it and invited me in. He was dressed in his army uniform and looked just like one of the many other artillery officers on board. It was so rough that it was impossible to kneel, so I had my confession standing up. The next morning at 6, Mass was held up in the old cocktail lounge. It was also held every morning at the same time, and I, though there are a lot better Catholics than myself, was darn glad to have the opportunity of going to church every day. On the 12th day, we were told that we were going to invade North Africa, then held by the French under the Nazis, and that we would have to go off ship, probably under fire. Little pamphlets were issued telling all about the customs of the people and how we were to conduct ourselves in that strange land, and personally, I think the pamphlets were a lot of hooey as far as some things were concerned. But when we were to pull into the harbor designated at Casablanca on the 13th day, we were notified that it was all jammed up with wrecked vessels, so we sweated out 5 more days going around in circles out in the ocean. till room was made for us to dock. Before I go on, I would like to mention the terrific poker and blackjack games that were held on the ship. Money was thrown around as though it were worthless. There was hundreds of small games on the boat, and usually one or two guys would case the game. In other words, win all the money in the game. Sometimes a very small operator with about a $5 bill in his pocket, today that's $99, folks, would get in a small game, get lucky, and break it, maybe winning $100. Today that's $1,981, and thus turn into a big operator. Upstairs, the same old cocktail lounge where they held mass every morning and where they sold supplies was turned into a regular casino, with almost every available space taken up by some kind of game. But over in one corner, they had a poker game for big operators only. These guys that cased the little games. The ante was anywhere from $2, today $39, to $5, today $99. And it wasn't a bit unusual for some pots to have $200, today $3,963, up to $250, today that's $4,954. Whew! Quite a game for guys, most of whom were making $50, today $990. There was one little private, name of Short Moore, who really hit a hot streak. He ran his holdings up to $990. You guys, today that's $19,617. And he said when he got up to $1,000, it's $19,815, he was going to quit. But like most gamblers, he went out of there talking to himself because in trying to win the last $10, today $198, he lost all of his $990. But such, they say, it is the inevitable end of the gambler. Things always look greener on the other side of the pastor, and it's a well-known fact that in the Army, the pastors for the officers are plenty much greener than those of the enlisted men who, as a rule, are generally looked upon, I think any GI will agree with me, as a pretty sore bunch of sad devils. And there are a lot of sad things that the sad jerk has to take. That, believe me, is pretty hard to absorb. Quite the contrary from the dirty, filthy conditions that prevailed in regards to our living and eating conditions on the boat, the officers lived really nicely. They lived in nice cabins with just about all the luxuries of home, ate in a very nice dining hall, laid around in nice lounges, and altogether had it pretty rosy. It was pretty tough sometimes to go to your mess hall, almost famished, take a look at the awful mess that was dished out to us, and disgustingly walk out still with an empty stomach, and have a waiter, dressed in white, brush against you carrying a tray of maybe some pie a la mode or something like that, which to us was only a dream. I actually think that if the people at home could see how their boys have to live sometimes, there would be really one heck of a stink raised. Especially when everyone realizes that the great mother, United States, is shelling out her best food by the tons and tons every day. I believe that lend-lease is plenty much okay, but I think too that the boys in the United States Army should be given the finest food available. But, as I mentioned before, the food on the ship was absolutely putrid, and I don't think there's any excuse for such a condition. Finally, on the 18th, we pulled into the harbor of Casablanca due to the fact that the French, very wisely, gave up without firing but a few shots. We did not encounter any trouble getting off the ship. Casablanca, as we pulled into the harbor, looked like a darn nice city, which surprised most of us. There wasn't much sign of any warfare around there, except in the harbor where there was quite a few ships that had either been sunk or disabled. With our bedding, roll, and bag on our back, our rifle belt loaded with ammunition, our rifle, and the little American flag wrapped around our arms, we unloaded from that terrible nightmare, the St. Helena, and began marching up through the town. Boy, it felt good to be on terra firma again. But I had a rather funny feeling being in that strange land and being in the midst of strange people. Casablanca's population consists of, besides the Arabs, of which there are by far more than anything else, French, Spanish, Jews, and other scattered nationalities. But that day, we hardly saw anyone but the Arabs. But that is because we were not even close to the main part of the city. They were dressed, of course, in their old traditional garments, a large flowing robe, and most of them with bare feet. A big part of the women had veils over their faces, and a lot of the little kids were completely nude. That day, as we marched through the streets, we stared and gaped at them. And they did likewise to us, probably thinking, what a bunch of funny-looking guys that are invading our land. We kept walking on through the town, the packs on our backs getting heavier all the time. We noticed a few French people, some walking along, others riding bikes, and they seemed to be dressed very nicely. We walked on out of town and out on a highway, and by that time the march was really getting tiresome, and we were beginning to sweat out where our destination was going to be. The sun was shining and it was very warm. However, there seemed to be a lot of dark clouds hanging around. I don't think that I have mentioned yet that, amongst the other stuff in our heavy pack, was 2-day rations, which were put up in boxes the size of a Cracker Jack box. These are called the K-ration. We kept trudging along and on and on, and finally, when we were about 4 miles out of Casablanca, we stopped, pulled off the highway, which incidentally was a pretty fair concrete highway, though rather narrow, and we went onto a grassy area which showed signs of being very damp. I guess we were a pretty miserable bunch of guys when we threw our packs and sprawled down to rest. We were very hungry, not having ate anything since breakfast. It was about 3 o'clock. After we caught our breath, we dug in our packs and got a catered dinner ration box, which contains 2 packs of tasteless cookies, a small can of American cheese, a small pack of synthetic lemonade powder, a box of dextrose tablets, a pack containing 4 cigarettes, and a stick of gum. We no sooner had got started eating when all of a sudden the rain just started pouring down. And before we could get our raincoats out and over us, we were all almost soaking wet. About that stage of the game, I guess a guy just doesn't give a damn what happens. It rained for a long time. Then, when it finally did let up a little, we were ordered to pitch our pup tents. Each man was equipped with what is called a shelter half, a tent pole, and 5 tent pins. When 2 shelter halves are buttoned together and staked down, you have a small tent slightly over 3 feet high and about 7 feet long, which are supposed to accommodate 2 men. I can recall how disappointed I was the first day I came into the army to live in those 30-bed barracks. Then how I moaned at the large 6-men tents at AP Hill, where at least you could stand up and you had a cot to sleep on. Now this little tent that Bill Wilts and I had pitched was to be our home. It seems that as time was going by, things in the army were getting plenty much tougher. We pitched our tent and laid out our blankets, 2 apiece, which, like everything else, was soaking wet. That night, we crawled under our damp blankets, and we were both snoring up a breeze in no time. About 11 o'clock, we both woke up shivering and miserable. The rain was pouring down again. The very thin pup tent was leaking in about 6 places, and a little stream of water was running right through the center of this tent, soaking up the blankets. You can imagine what an uncomfortable feeling that was. There was no more sleeping that night, which seemed to never end. Just like my dear friend Kara said in last week's episode, somebody always has it worse off than you. And that's very true. There are times when I complain about stuff that I probably have no business whatsoever complaining about. I think we're all guilty about that from one time to another. And then it takes things like reading my grandpa's journal, right? Or talking to a dear friend who is going through turmoil. And it makes me stop dead in my tracks. Dakota. That's my word. And complaining, someone says Dakota and I just stop immediately. Another example is when my friend Leif, he was in the show Survivor. And we had a discussion and he was just saying how there was no electricity, there was no bathroom, no amenities, no luxury, no restaurant, no nothing. You know, things that we take advantage of, or maybe not advantage, but we definitely take these things for granted. I could go into my closet right now and pull out a roll of toilet paper or paper towels or napkins or anything, you know. Or if I'm tired, I can go into my big old nice king-size bed that welcomes me every single night. But sometimes, like in Leif's case with Survivor, where you have to sleep on the ground or make your own bed out of rocks and twigs and whatever else the land provides for you, or my grandpa having to share a tiny, tiny little tent that's leaking in half a dozen spots with another full-grown man, or yikes, Private Short, losing 990 big ones while trying to win his final $10. Yes, there's always somebody that has it worse than you and me, and I think it's good to remember that. Make us be more grateful for what we do have. I really truly do love reading my grandfather's writings. You know, the time that he spent there stayed with him until his death. It never left his heart. He never forgot. Once a soldier, always a soldier. So, just a heads up everyone, I have been running around like crazy the past several days as I am headed to Colorado for the season, and we have been busy building and completing our very first teardrop trailer that we will be bringing with us to Colorado loaded with stuff. And on top of that, every day I've been working on the book and working on my podcast. So I will be making that long trek as you are listening to this episode, and I will be stuck in the mountains for a short time after, so I don't want to leave you high and dry and episode-less. So since I have this written out already, I will be doing another grandpa episode next week. And boy, let's just say you don't want to miss this one. Did you enjoy this week's episode? Listen to the others, they're all phenomenal. Haven't heard every single one yet? No need to fret. Or as my grandpa would say, you don't need to sweat it out. You can hit up any of those podcast platforms such as Spotify, Blueberry, Deezer, Apple Podcasts. Basically, wherever you may roam to hear your other spooky podcasts, you'll probably find Paranormal Brothers Podcast lurking in the background. Thanks, everyone, and I will see you next week.